Thank you very much, Yitzi and Birchus, Rabbi Fuld. Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here this morning on this cold morning to speak to all of you. It's a pleasure and an honor to be able to speak with Rabbi Brander and, of course, with Rabbi Dr. Reichman and Dr. Agus here this morning. This venue actually has particular meaning to me because I spent 10 years in this building from nursery through eighth grade. Before it was the Schottenstein Center of YU, it was YRMS, Yeshiva Rabbi Moses Soloveitchik. And I was actually thinking that the last time that I stood on the bima of this beautiful shul, speaking from this podium, was in 1980 at my eighth grade graduation 35 years ago. And I was reflecting on that as I was thinking about the topic of today's discussion about the concept of egg freezing and thinking about the fact that 35 years ago, the first IVF baby born in the world was not yet 2 years old. And talk about IVF and test tube babies was all the rage throughout the country and throughout the world at the time. Everybody was discussing and debating the various aspects, the medical aspects, the social, the ethical, the moral, the religious aspects of IVF. And over the course of the ensuing years, many advances have been made in the field of reproductive medicine, advances such as ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, advances such as embryo freezing, advances such as PGD, which you heard about from Rabbi Dr. Reichman, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And all of these advances have engendered the same kind of discussion and debate about these various aspects, the medical, the social, the ethical, the moral, the religious aspects of all these various techniques. But really, over the past 2 years, a new technique has emerged, which has become a game changer in the world of reproductive medicine and actually in the general world beyond, or at least a potential game changer. And this is the technique of egg freezing, of being able to freeze the human oocyte, the human egg. I was asked to give an introduction to the medical aspects of egg freezing, following which Rabbi Brander will elaborate and give a plenary discussion on the further background to this. So let me just begin by telling you all what we all know, that the concept of freezing things, such as food, for example, we've been familiar with that as people from time immemorial. We know that if you take some kind of food item and you put it in ice, you put it in an ice box, now we put it in our freezer, we can preserve it. We can retard bacterial growth. We can prevent it from spoiling. We can thaw that food item, and we find that it's edible and it's fit for consumption. And this concept of freezing things to preserve them, we've tried for a long time to extend this concept to a living cell and living tissue. And it's much harder to do for a living cell to freeze it and thaw it successfully than it is for meat and chicken in your freezer for a couple of reasons. First of all, a living cell, you have to get it to a much colder temperature in order to successfully freeze and in order to successfully thaw it in a way that it will survive. And the reason you need to get it to a really, really low temperature is because every cell has a process of metabolism, a metabolic process that proceeds continuously and constantly every second of every minute of every hour of every day. And that metabolism leads the cell in its aging process to eventual senescence and cell death. Every cell eventually dies. It has a lifespan. And its metabolic process leads to that aging process, which leads to its death. And so if you want to freeze that cell successfully, you have to try to arrest the metabolic processes of that cell. And in order to do that, you really need to get as close as possible to absolute zero, which is zero Kelvin, about 450 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. That's the temperature at which all molecular motion in the universe ceases. And if you want to stop a cell's metabolism, you really need to get not just to the 32 degrees Fahrenheit that we keep fish in our freezer at, but you need to get as close to absolute zero as possible to just stop the aging of that cell so that when you thaw it, Years later, it will continue right from where it was when you initially froze it. And this second challenge with freezing living cells and tissue has to do with ice. About 2/3 to 3/4 of our bodies consists of water. And most of that water is intracellular. Most of that water is within the 100 trillion cells in our bodies. Every cell, each cell, has about 60 to 70% water by volume. And what happens if you freeze water? It becomes ice. Ice is crystalline. Ice crystals are sharp and they're jagged. And ice crystals can tear apart a cell. They can disrupt the ultrastructure of the cell. They can disrupt the cytoskeleton and the organelles of the cell so that you freeze it and you thaw it and it doesn't survive. There was a lot of research into the cryobiology of living cells, the ability to try to freeze living cells, mostly in the beginning in the 1940s. Actually, most of the research focused on sperm cells and was motivated by the cattle industry, which was looking to be able to freeze cattle sperm for breeding purposes. And this research into the early research into cryobiology culminated really in 1949 with the first successful freeze and thaw of a sperm cell, which then led a few years later in the mid-1950s to the birth of the first child, the first human child from a frozen and thawed sperm cell. And the way that we found that we can successfully freeze a living cell is by trying to work with both of those challenges, the temperature challenge and the ice challenge, by taking certain chemicals which are called cryoprotectants. These are chemicals that do not freeze as crystals, as water does. These are chemicals like glycerol and propanediol. We now often use DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide. We often use also the colloquially known as antifreeze, ethylene glycol. And what you do is you replace the water in the cell with these cryoprotectants. You remove the water and put the cryoprotectants into the cell. And then you slow freeze the cell. You slowly bring the temperature of the cell down by about 1 degree Celsius per minute until you get it all the way down to the temperature of liquid nitrogen. Liquid nitrogen is a substance that exists at about 350 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. And then you store the cell at that temperature in a cryotank that contains liquid nitrogen. It does evaporate, but you constantly replenish it. And you can successfully reverse that freezing process and thaw the cell by bringing it slowly back up to body temperature and by re-replacing the cryoprotectants in the cell with water. And you can do this very successfully with many different kinds of cells, beginning with those sperm cells and continuing with other kinds of cells. You can do this very successfully with embryos. The first IVF baby was born in 1978, and it was not so much after that, only about 6 years later, that there was the first baby born from a successfully frozen and thawed embryo. So you can use these techniques for freezing many different kinds of cells. But the egg, the human egg, is different. The human egg is a unique kind of cell in the body in many regards. In terms of its size, it's about a 1/10 of a millimeter in size. You can actually see it with the naked eye, and that's unusual for the rest of the cells in the body. It's also the rarest cell in the human body. If we have 100 trillion cells consisting of various different cell types, the egg, there are only about 400,000 eggs when a girl is 12, 13 years old, and that's it. But aside from its being the largest and the rarest cell in the body, it also presents two additional challenges to freezing it. Number one, it has a much higher water content than the rest of the cells in the body. Whereas most cells in the body have about a 60 to 70% water content, the egg has about a 90% water content by volume, which means that almost the entire egg consists of water, which means that the freezing process, where you replace all of that water with cryoprotectants, you're replacing essentially 90% of the cell with cryoprotectants, and the freeze-thaw process is much more traumatic for that egg than it will be for any other cell in the body. And number two, maybe more importantly, the egg exists in a much more delicate state. The time that we can freeze eggs is when they're mature eggs, most successfully. But the challenge of a mature egg is that a mature egg exists in a very delicate condition. Eggs are produced really only before a female is born. Eggs are produced during gestational life. And when an egg is produced during gestational life, it begins its process of meiosis, right, which results in egg formation. It gets into the first meiotic division, meiosis one. It gets to prophase of meiosis one. And at that point, meiosis arrests in fetal life. It just stops. It ceases. Meiosis does not continue for that egg until decades later, when that female fetus becomes an adult reproductive age woman, and that egg is ready to ovulate. When it's ready to ovulate, then it resumes meiosis, the arrest is lifted, and it continues into the second meiotic division, and it actually stops again, it arrests again, and metaphase of meiosis two. At that point, it's called a mature egg, we call it an M2, and it's ready to be able to be fertilized. Once it's fertilized by the sperm, then this second meiotic arrest is lifted again, and meiosis continues to completion so that the DNA of the egg and of the sperm can successfully merge and form a new embryo. But because that egg is sitting, that mature egg is sitting in metaphase of meiosis two, the chromosomes are lined up at opposite poles of the egg and are connected with very fine protein filaments, which collectively are called the spindle apparatus. And this spindle is necessary for the functionality of this egg, for it to be able to be fertilized. And the spindle is very delicate, so if you freeze the cell, if you replace it with cryoprotectants and you drop the temperature and then you reverse the process and thaw it, you can imagine that it's very easily disrupted. The spindle is very easily disrupted, so that the egg might itself survive the thaw, but its functionality won't. It won't be able to fertilize, won't be able to become an embryo, won't be able to become a pregnancy. So these are additional challenges which made it very difficult to be able to freeze the human egg. But over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of research into a new technique of freezing, which is called vitrification. Vitrification, V-I-T-R, is a Latin word that relates to glass, like in vitro fertilization means fertilizing in glass, in a glass test tube, in a glass petri dish in the laboratory. Vitrification is essentially glassification, where instead of slow freezing a cell, you can take the cell and flash freeze it really, really quickly. You take the cell and you essentially immerse it in liquid nitrogen so that you precipitously drop the temperature of the cell from body temperature 98 degrees Fahrenheit all the way down to 350 below zero in a second or less. And when you flash freeze the cell, it doesn't give the ice, the water in the cell, a chance to form ice crystals. The whole cell basically freezes suddenly in place, looking almost like a glass model of the original cell. And then when you thaw it, it was really literally frozen in time. And when you thaw it, it thaws really very nicely. And this vitrification technique, we've been able to apply to human eggs very, very well and very effectively and very reliably and very predictably, such that about 2 years ago, a little more than 2 years ago, the Professional Society of the World of Reproductive Medicine, the ASRM, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, officially removed the designation of experimental for egg freezing, which means that now, as of over the past couple of years, clinicians, physicians are now able to offer patients egg freezing without it being under an experimental protocol, under a research protocol, without having to get review and approval by an IRB, by an institutional review board. This is now considered to be in the mainstream armamentarium of clinical medicine. And so we've now been using egg freezing more and more among patients for actual clinical situations. And I'd like to just briefly review some of the clinical situations that I can offer patients egg freezing in. And Rabbi Brander will elaborate on these and on the many other extra medical aspects of the ability to offer egg freezing to patients. One simple situation where I can offer egg freezing to patient is I'm I have a couple right now where they both live in Jamaica. They're coming to see, in the islands of Jamaica. They're coming to see me for IVF, but they're both busy professionals. The husband is an attorney in Jamaica, and he can't make it up here now. The wife is in business, and she's able to make it here now and not later. So now she can come up to me. I can do IVF on her. I can freeze her eggs. Don't have to worry about making embryos yet. And then when her husband is able to come up here to the U.S. in a couple of months, then I can thaw those eggs, hopefully fertilize them with the husband's sperm, and then the woman will come back and I'll be able to transfer those embryos into her uterus. So this is one situation, one easy situation where we can now benefit from egg freezing. A second situation is for egg donation. And this is really changing the world of egg donation. The existence of sperm banks have been in existence for a very long time, where people anonymously donate sperm. Sperm banks have databases of their anonymous egg donors. You can go online to any accredited commercial sperm bank in the United States, California Cryobank. You can go online, look at their databases, find an anonymous sperm donor, have the sperm shipped anywhere in the continental U.S., and use that to help achieve a pregnancy. Egg donation was not able to be done that way because egg freezing was not reliable. Now that we can freeze eggs, there's a burgeoning industry of companies which are creating egg banks, just like sperm banks. And these egg banks will recruit egg donors, remove their eggs, freeze them, hold on to them, create databases of these anonymous egg donors. And women are now able to go to these egg banks, select donors, have the eggs shipped, again, anywhere they want, and help to create a pregnancy using these donor eggs. And this is, again, just beginning. This is just in the early stages and will continue to really blossom over the next years for sure. Then there are medical situations which are very useful, where egg freezing is very useful to be able to offer to patients. For example, so if God forbid a woman of reproductive age is diagnosed with some sort of cancer that requires treatment with a chemotherapeutic agent, and let's say the chemotherapy that is expected to be used is known to be gonadotoxic. It's known to be toxic to a person's ovaries and eggs, so that we're worried that we're hopeful that the chemotherapy will work and this woman will have a refuah shleima, but at the end of the process, she might not have any functional eggs left, and she might be in a chemotherapy-induced menopause. So now, if it's medically feasible to delay the chemotherapy by a little bit without affecting the chances of success of the treatment for the cancer, we can delay it by a little bit, remove this woman's eggs, and freeze them and hold on to them so that if, in the future, she hopefully survives and is in good health and is hoping to be able to have a genetic child, she can use those frozen eggs. Another example is what Dr. Agus and Rabbi Dr. Reichman were talking about before. If someone, for example, has a BRCA mutation and is recommended that she undergo a prophylactic oophorectomy, that her ovaries be removed prophylactically, and she wants that procedure to be done, but she's a young reproductive age woman and she does not want to go into a surgically induced menopause where she cannot have genetic children in the future. What you can do is you can now freeze her eggs and hold on to them. You can do that even for several months and freeze. You can freeze 20 eggs if you want. You can freeze 50 eggs if you want and hold on to them so that in the future, after she has her oophorectomy, she can still become a genetic mother using these eggs. Also, another genetic situation, if a woman is a carrier for Fragile X syndrome. So Fragile X is something that, it's a syndrome which typically affects men, but women can be carriers for Fragile X. But unlike many other recessive genetic diseases, where if you're a carrier, it doesn't affect your life at all, that's not necessarily the case for Fragile X. Fragile X being a carrier for that is not meaningless. Women who carry the Fragile X mutation can be at risk for something called a premature ovarian failure, where actually their ovaries run out of eggs sooner than other people's might, and they might go through an early menopause. So let's say you have an 18-year-old young woman or a 20-year-old young woman who knows that she's carrying the Fragile X mutation, and she knows she's at risk for having a premature ovarian failure, she can actually freeze tens of eggs, hold on to them, and then she knows, at least has some peace of mind to know, maybe it's a b'dieved peace of mind, not a l'chatchila, but still at least she knows that if in the future she goes into a premature menopause and has these eggs frozen, she can still become a genetic mother. And then comes really this sea change in the world of reproductive medicine. And really this could potentially become a sea change in the world in general, and is already starting that way. If you do a Google search for elective egg freezing for fertility preservation, you will get so many hits all over the internet, all over the social media. People throughout the country, and certainly in big cities like Manhattan, Los Angeles, are actually starting to have egg freezing parties. It's this whole unbelievable thing which is developing, which could really change so many aspects of life as we know it. You know, IVF has been such a big benefit to the world. It's brought, with the help of IVF, there are almost 2 million babies which have been born worldwide over the past 35 plus years. So IVF, if about, let's say, 10 to 15% of couples in the general population suffer from fertility issues, and a percentage of those will be helped with IVF, it's a relatively small percentage of the general population that is helped by IVF. Egg freezing is something which can potentially affect, potentially benefit, but certainly impact on 50% of the population, every female in the world, because elective egg freezing is not something which is only offered now, which we're starting to offer now for people not only with medical conditions, not only with a diagnosis, not only for a medical treatment, but for purely social and elective reasons. And this creates a whole, really, host of issues that Rabbi Brander is certainly going to address. Aside from the number of people that it's affecting, it's really changing something which has been kind of a brick wall almost in human physiology for time immemorial. Always, we know that the age of human menopause has pretty much remained steady, completely steady over the centuries. The age of menopause, the age at which a woman's eggs, the number of eggs inside of a woman's ovaries decreases to essentially zero, is pretty much rock stable in the mid to late 40s or early 50s. That doesn't change. That age of menopause has been the same for centuries. And that the loss of eggs in a person's ovary has been, in reproductive medicine, in the therapy that we can offer patients, that's been a brick wall. We can't get past that. That's something that Hashem does not allow us to get around. If a man has very low sperm counts, we can work with that. If a woman has blocked fallopian tubes, we can work with that. If a woman has a problem with ovulation, we can work with that. But if a woman is menopausal and does not have any eggs in her ovaries, we don't know how to make new eggs. Eggs are only produced in fetal life and not afterwards. We don't know how to do that. There's a lot of active research going on into that, but we've not been able to get through that brick wall. We've been able to sometimes walk around that brick wall by using things like egg donation. It's a different story. But now egg freezing presents the possibility of actually shattering that brick wall and actually allowing women who are 50 years old and are menopausal, but who have eggs frozen from when she was 30 years old, to actually become a genetic mother. So how do we deal with this? Because there are also risks in pregnancy when a person is in her 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s compared with pregnancy in her 20s and 30s. But now that brick wall is shattered, so there's really nothing preventing a 60-year-old woman from walking into an IVF clinic and saying, my eggs are frozen from when I was 30 years old, and I want to have a baby. So I'm going to stop the medical background at this point, and I'm going to turn the floor over to Rabbi Brander, who will take it from here and give us the plenary discussion on issues relating to egg freezing. Thank you all.
Thank you, Rabbi Dr. Levine. That was, it's hard to do that in such a short period of time, but thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be able to come together and talk about these important issues, and thank you for braving the cold to be able to do it, to be here with Dr. Agus, Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman, is a privilege and a pleasure. I want to just take a moment to thank the Folds, Rabbi and Mrs. Fold, not only for all of you in this room having the opportunity to hear about this topic, not only for the thousands that will listen to it over the course of the next week or so on YU Torah, but because of the Folds, the entire YU campus on issues of medical ethics in general has really been transformed. The fact that testing, genetic testing is done at Yeshiva University. Did not happen in my time, did not happen 10 or 15 years after I went to YU, or 20 years after I went to YU, but it is the norm now, and it's the norm because of the culture that the Medical Ethics Society, with the help of the Folds, have created. Thousands of young people are now tested before they get married because of the culture that the Folds helped to create through the Medical Ethics Society. Whether it's that, whether it's the fact that students are very engaged in various issues of medical ethics, and more young men and young women have made the decision to be engaged in various aspects of being medical professionals. A lot of that has to do with the work of the Medical Ethics Society, and a lot of that has to do also with the people who have made the Medical Ethics Society possible, and that is the Folds. So we thank you, Me'omek Libi, for making that happen. Thank you. So I would like to move, time is limited, and both Rabbi Levine and I have a wedding that I know I have to be at a certain period, at a certain time. Time is limited. I want to start out with, before we go through the sources, hopefully you have the sources in front of you, you have the handouts. I want to start out with the punchline and then move to the sources. In a conversation that both Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and Rav Usher Weiss had on the issue of egg oocyte cryopreservation, they both supported the issue of oocyte cryopreservation, not only for the issue of freezing eggs to help cancer patients, as Dr. Levine spoke about, but also particularly to help with young women who want to wait to have a child until they get married, but feel like the clock, so to say, as Dr. Levine spoke about, is running out. And instead of having to make a decision, and that is to have a child on their own by getting a sperm donation or by asking a friend to donate sperm, they're able to postpone the ability to have a child until they find the right young person or until they find the right gentleman, and to be able to have a family where both husband and wife, mother and father, can bring up the child. Oocyte cryopreservation has helped make sure that the pressure that often singles feel in their 30s can be obviated through the idea of oocyte cryopreservation. And therefore, both Rav Usher Weiss and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein have endorsed this procedure, especially in these cases, so that the pressure that often women feel in their mid-30s if they're not yet married can be obviated. With that in mind, with the punchline in mind, and the recognition of the fact that we endorse this idea of oocyte cryopreservation, I'd like to now move to some of the sources and perhaps leave a few minutes for questions. We turn to the first source. I'm not going to do them all inside, but if we turn to the first source, this is a source that I try to use often when we have conversations on this issue, and that is the famous Me'iri. The Me'iri in Sanhedrin speaks about the idea that koshu nasa bepula tivit, anything that will, he speaks about what's the difference between witchcraft, which the Torah forbids one to benefit from, and science, which the Torah welcomes. And he says that any advances that are achieved through the natural science are obviously not considered magic, and magic being prohibited. And he goes on and he says, this is the Me'iri, one of the Rishonim, goes on to say that there will come a time when science will know how to create human beings without the need for the natural intimate act. And he explains that this has already been discussed within Kabbalistic literature, and that it's not an impossibility, and it is permitted to be involved in such procedures, for they are considered within the order of nature, not in the category of magic, but rather in the category of science. This again reminds us that all of the procedures, whether it is the issues and the important ideas that Dr. Agus was discussing, Dr. Reichman was discussing, as well as Rabbi Dr. Levine was discussing, these are all within the halachic parameters of Virapo Yerape, the responsibilities that we have to be God's junior partner in advancing society and being able to be involved in the process, a form of tikkun olam. And if we move to the second source, the Gemara in Baba Batra, the Gemara in Baba Batra has a famous conversation, again, a source that I think creates a framework for our conversation between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva. This is a source that I've written about. It's a source that Rabbi Dr. Torsky, a blessed memory from Harvard University, would discuss greatly. And that is that Rabbi Akiva is having a conversation with a Roman governor of Judea, where the Roman governor of Judea says that the reason why the Jewish people are condemned to hell is because they help the poor. After all, God has condemned these individuals to live lives in which they have no food, no ability to feed themselves. And when a Jew or anybody who wants to be philanthropic helps this individual, they're going against the will of God. And you, the Jewish people, says Turnus Rufus, are called the servants of God, and therefore you have no right to interfere with the destiny or the fate that God has decided for this person, that this person should be poor and have difficulty sustaining themselves. Rabbi Akiva's response is, suppose an earthly king incarcerated his child and said, no one should give my child food or drink, and someone snuck food or drink to the child. Would not the king be excited? Would not the king be appreciative of this individual that defied him? And we are not just called the servants of God, but banim atem l'Hashem Elokeichem, we are also called the children of God. And therefore, what we're doing is not against the will of the king, of the King of Kings, but rather we are helping God's children. Dr. Tversky explained that the difference between Rabbi Akiva and Turnus Rufus philosophically is that Turnus Rufus feels that when we engage in society, we are to wear the eyeglasses of God, as if we know what God wanted, as if we know what God wanted there to be within the world, and therefore we have no right to interfere with the world. Whereas the Jewish approach is, the approach of Rabbi Akiva is, that we do not take a providential view of the world, but rather we realize that we are God's junior partner, and we have the right and the ability to change the world. And for those who are struggling, whether it's struggling to sustain themselves from the perspective of feeding themselves, whether it's the struggle that someone may have with certain genetic challenges, whether it's the struggle that one may have regarding the wish to be able to have a natural child, a genetic child, but due to challenges like cancer or other challenges that one is at this point in time not able to do so, that when God has allowed us to open our eyes through the conduit of science, that we are to celebrate that conduit and we are to use that conduit. But yet we are to remember what the Gemara in Shabbos says. The Gemara in Shabbos tells us that after 120 years, God asks us a whole bunch of questions. The Sata v'Natata b'Emuna, were we involved faithfully with business? Notice in this list of questions, it doesn't ask if we ate glatt kosher meat or drank glatt Chalav Yisrael orange juice, but rather it asks us whether we filled out our IRS forms properly and what the issues are with that. And then it says later on in the conversation, Asakta b'piria v'rivya, were you involved in the act of procreation? Often the sentence is mistranslated as, did you fulfill the mitzvah of procreation? Notice that's not the Hebrew word or the Aramaic word. The word is not kiyamta, did you fulfill, but asakta, did you try? We are not God, we are not divine. We should try to have children. We should try to actualize the opportunity to guarantee the future of the world through our children. But it is not that the Torah tells us or the Gemara tells us that you have to kiyamta, you have to fulfill it, but at least you have to try, asakta. But yet, and I will skip to a source and we'll move back, source number six, Tosfot in source number six, in discussing the issue of the Paschal sacrifice, reminds us that a person who is not circumcised cannot fulfill the mitzvah of having a Paschal sacrifice or other halachot within kachim, within the laws of certain sacrifices within the Beit HaMikdash, within the temple. This is not the time to go through those halachot. We'll focus on the Paschal sacrifice. But Tosfos reminds us that if a person whose brother has passed away because of the act of circumcision, even though he does not require to be circumcised because it can be a risk, or a person who requires a surgery in order to perform circumcision, in other words, a more in-depth surgery in order to be able to reveal the testicles, in order to be able to create, to be able to do circumcision. Tolso says that that is not a halachic requirement in order to fulfill the mitzvah of circumcision, in order to be able to eat the paschal sacrifice. My point being that while science has given us so many opportunities that Dr. Levine has so spoken about with such clarity, it is not a halachic mandate to use those opportunities. We should realize that those opportunities are there for us. And when, unfortunately, Torah personalities who are not familiar with the science and therefore shy away from endorsing these procedures, I think that's a form of rabbinic malpractice. But we should also realize that while we can engage in using these opportunities, it is also important to realize that it is not a halachic mandate that thou must use those opportunities in order to be able to have children. It is a mitzvah to try to have children. It is an opportunity to use science. It is not a mandated obligation to use these heroic activities, which all of these scientific opportunities are, due to the fact that one has to go through many different procedures in order to fulfill it, whether it's hormonal therapy or other therapies. I'm not talking about genetic testing. I'm talking about, in particular here, the ability to have a child. It's not halachically obligated that you use those methods of science. Moving back to source number four, it's important for us to realize that while the mitzvah of having a child, the mitzvah pruravu, is within the orbit of a mitzvah that men are obligated to do, women also have an obligation, l'shevet yitzura, to be able to be involved in procreation, in populating the world. It's two different mitzvot. There are different ramifications to those mitzvot, which, again, are beyond the scope of the initial conversation here. And we know that from the halacha, because the halacha in source number four tells us in the Shulchan Aruch, Ein mochrim sefer Torah, one cannot sell a sefer Torah, elakidei lomod Torah, in order to, unless you're going to sell the sefer Torah to study Torah, ulisa isha, or to marry a woman. The Taz tells us, why is it permitted to sell a sefer Torah to study Torah? But he says, ubichlal lisa isha lahasi yisomim v'yisomos mishum de'isha mitzaveh nami l'kayim shevet yitzurah. That one should realize the ability to sell a sefer Torah is not just to help a man get married in order that he can fulfill the mitzvah per revu, but also to help a woman fulfill her mitzvah of being able to populate the world. This is also concretized by the Rishonim, namely the Ran on the Rif in Megillah, on Daf Chet Amid Beis, where the Ran on the Rif clearly states that says, Isha Nami, a woman also, the obligation is to sell a sefer Torah to help her get married, because of the halachic responsibility of a woman to be involved in procreation. However, there are some that may suggest that there should be a prohibition of oocyte cryopreservation, because the same way it is forbidden for a man to waste his sperm, to waste the seed of procreation, that perhaps for the woman, there's a prohibition for the woman to waste her seed, namely the egg, in the act of procreation when it's not yet at the stage of procreation. So when I harvest an egg for a woman who's going through cancer treatments, or I harvest an egg for a woman who's single and wants to wait until she finds the right person in order to have a child with, and therefore she harvests eggs in order to make sure that the biological clock does not cause her to compromise, perhaps that is a form of wasting one's seed. And we know that women are forbidden to waste one seed based on several different posts, several different Rishonim. For example, the Tosfos in Yevamos, source number 7, we're told, in the Minchas Chinuch, we're told that, in the Ramban in Nida, we're told that, that it's forbidden for a woman to waste her seed, so to say. But yet, and as well as in source number 10, where we're also told that a woman is forbidden to waste her seed. But yet, we are to be reminded of the fact that while it is clear that the prohibition of wasting seed is much more substantial by a man than it is a woman, we are reminded, and therefore the proof case that I'm going to use is a good proof case. We are reminded by the fact by that Rav Moshe Feinstein, in source number 11, highlights the fact that when sperm, or for that matter in this case, harvesting an oocyte, is used, in the case of sperm, to test the sperm, or to use sperm to freeze it so that in the future a man can have a child, that is not called wasting sperm. Anytime sperm is being extracted in order to test the sperm or to use it for the future in order to have a child, that is not considered wasting sperm, but rather that's the mitzvah peruvu. One is trying to, one is working to try to have a child. The same thing would be true with oocyte cryopreservation, where the purpose is not simply just to be involved in a hormonal-inducing act, which eventually causes the stimulation of the follicles, which eventually allows one to harvest oocytes. That's not being done for a happenstance reason, but rather it's being done to help a woman celebrate the opportunity to fulfill the commandment of making sure that the world continues to be populated. Rav Moshe Feinstein reminds us of this in clarity. There are two tshuvas. One is brought down in source number 11. And there is also a famous comment by Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, where Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg is asked the following, Bechur Ravak. And the reason why these questions have not been asked about a woman yet is simply because, as Dr. Levine said, oocyte cryopreservation has moved into the status of being part and parcel of the repertoire that a fertility specialist can offer only in the past 2 years. So this is cutting-edge issues. But we see from Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg's conversation, very brief, tshuva, where a single man who is about to undergo chemotherapy, and therefore it could in some ways cause him to lose the ability to have sperm, can he extract sperm as a single man in order to be able to hold it so when he gets married, he can use it? And Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, in a one-word answer, just says, mutter, it's permitted. And therefore, if that is true for a man, where the issues are much greater, for example, there's an issue, a prohibition of castration for a man, of sirus, that there isn't for a woman. So if the proof text can be found that by men we permit sperm to be extracted in order to be able to use it for the future to have children, then benoshel kal v'chomer, surely that this would be permitted to be able to do oocyte cryopreservation in order to be able to help a woman for the future, whether she's going through cancer treatments or whether she just wants to postpone or have a little extra runway, so to say, in order that she can find the right person so that she can bring up a family together. Some may argue that the prohibition here is that this is considered an act of chavala. This is considered an act of injury. That it might be it's prohibited to be involved in any type of operation that isn't mandatory. So maybe, unlike in the case with a man, where it's not an whether in most cases when you're not doing fine needle aspiration or other things of that nature, you don't need to go through an operation in order to be able to extract sperm, then maybe in the case of a woman, it's an issue of chavala. It's an issue of injury that is not permitted. And that's based on the Rambam in Hilchos Chova Omazik, where the Rambam says, Asur la'adam lachbo ben ba'atzma ben chavera, a person cannot injure himself or herself or a friend. Belo achobo bovad, eloko amaka adam kasher mi'Yisrael. Anybody who hurts another individual, ben katan, ben gadol, ben ish, ben isha, whether it's young or whether it's, you know, pre-bar bat mitzvah or post, whether it's a man or a woman, derech nitzayon, For reasons that are just not purposeful, that are also perhaps embarrassing, Over Belotase transgresses the negative precept of Lo Yosif Lahakoso. And therefore, the Rambam goes on and he says, if we warn that someone who deserves to have lashes, you can't increase the lashes, so surely a person who there is no reason to injure, if you injure them, if you allow them to go through an operation that has no immediate benefits, who says that's permitted? This question has also been dealt with by Rav Moshe Feinstein, not on the issue of oocyte cryopreservation again, because first of all, Rav Moshe Feinstein was not alive during that time. It's only a two-year-old, really, Shaila. But Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked this Shaila about women going through types of plastic surgery. Would that be considered a chavala? Would that be considered a form of wounds that are not permitted? And Rav Moshe Feinstein clearly indicated that if a woman wants to go through a process of plastic surgery, that is not considered chavala shelo etzorech. That's not considered a forbidden thing because there is purpose for it. It's not derech nitzayon ubizayon. It's not for an embarrassing reason. It's for a purposeful reason. Any type of operation or any type of procedure in which there is purpose for it, the prohibition of chavala, the prohibition of injury and of a prohibition of injury is removed. So if we permit one to undergo a surgery in order to be able to go through some forms of plastic surgery, again, it is easy to use that as a jumping off point and clearly indicate that a woman's wanting to be able to have children in the future or based on either cancer treatments or a situation where a woman is in her 30s or 40s, and she's still single and she wants to be able to have children and postpone the biological clock, but yet still have the runway to find the right person. So that's 100% permitted. If Rav Moshe Feinstein creates this permission in this case, so surely in the case that we're talking about where there's the mitzvah performing the ability to procreate, it should be 100% permitted. And finally, lest one think that somebody who has a child this way, in other words, not through the standard act of intimacy, that in some way is a lower level of celebrating the mitzvah. Lest one think that this is not as good as having a child in the standard normal way. We are reminded of the tshuva of the Minchas Yitzchak, where the Minchas Yitzchak reminds us, and again, the Minchas Yitzchak was not known to be modern Orthodox. He was more within the camp of the right-wing community, a significant Torah personality, where the Minchas Yitzchak reminds us that any couple or that any person that goes through the medical fertility procedures that is considered hishtadlus rav, great energy, great effort, and that when one has a child by going through these heroic means that pshita, it's simple, sheyishlam shekayim l'chuli alma mitzvah peruvu, that one has performed the mitzvah per revu. And even though it's not the standard act of intimacy that we're all accustomed to, that does not in any ways compromise the ability for one to celebrate the fact that one has performed the mitzvah of having a child and fulfilled the obligation and allowed oneself to be HaKadosh Baruch Hu's junior partner in being able to continue the creation of the world and to perfect the creation that HaKadosh Baruch Hu began. Any questions? Rabbi Fold has a question. He comes first, okay? We'll take a few questions.
Thank you. In the first volume of Shutim of Usher Weiss, he writes about PGD, and I think he talks about general reproductive technique, that it's not a mitzvah peruvu, you can't impose it, but you should encourage it, and who does it, it's a kiyum of peruvu, a giant step forward. But our policy in Shari Tzedek has been to address pathology only. To address pathology.
Okay.
Illness, things that aren't good. Not if somebody wants a taller kid, or for the three of us, We might all want kids who can grow hair after age 40. Those aren't considered pathology. I personally did severe battle on eliminating BRCA1. The hospital rabbi was quite bothered by it. And by a mother who had congenital cataracts in her kids. And there was an argument about that. Question of the 35-year-old gal who's single, and I think you missed my earlier remarks, so you'll hear my prejudice now.
Okay.
Someplace the Rabbanim need Malkus, that there's a 35-year-old girl who's single in such quantities in this generation. And I don't know, this is a very tough one, that we've adequately discussed the preservation of eggs for young single women. Maybe that'll promote this culture of singleton. And I think at some point, Rabbanim had a better look at a mea culpa and al-chait. This needs to be corrected before you freeze a bunch of eggs.
So thank you very much. I agree with you 100%, Rabbi Fold. First of all, on the PGD issue, we are of like minds. I published an article in Tradition on this issue where most of my colleagues disagreed with me and felt that issues of sex selection or color selection and stuff like that could still be permitted. I, even though what they forgot, I will never know in Torah, I still am bothered by using PGD from that perspective. It's nice to know that you follow that perspective. But Rapi, I agree with you. Not all the poskim concur with that. And again, I have an article in Tradition discussing this. The other issue is something that I have spent several years working on, and that is the issue of trying to deal with the singles issue. I think that this is not a conversation, again, in celebration of the fact on singles. I have two weddings that I will be able to celebrate of students today, and I know that I'm being honored underneath the chuppah, and I'm looking at that clock to make sure I don't get called up like some rabbis and not be there. But I think, you know, as somebody who was involved and is still involved with YU Connects, not YU Connects just particular, but the whole issue of singles, there is a tremendous issue here about how to deal with singles in general and how to deal with priorities. And we have to make sure that it's not viewed as that young people don't let us look at this as they're in a crisis, because I think they're turned off by that. But we need to find additional, more effective ways to deal with issues of singles. All of us need to work on that, whether all your children are married, none of your children are married. We all have to be part of YU Connects, and I don't mean YU Connects, I mean Connects in general. There are larger issues here of narratives that we should be discussing, and we need to discuss. It is an extremely complicated issue. It is a challenge, and maybe that's not the right word to use, of this generation, but it is something that we need to deal with. And I am constantly reminded by my students that the language in which we have this conversation is as important as coming to solutions. So I agree with you 100%. In my limited experience, I have found that in situations in which you promote oocyte cryopreservation, it's not about a public promotion, but it's about giving people that opportunity. I think it's a good thing, but your issue is not lost on the fact that we need to, oocyte cryopreservation, if that's the only thing in the arsenal dealing with singles, then we've done the whole thing a disservice. Sure.
Thank you very much. I was wondering what happens to the oocytes or the sperm if they're not being used, or like if they've only used some of them, and then they don't use some of the sperm or some of the oocytes. And does it have halachic parameters if the condition is that if you use it, then it's mutar, but if you don't use it, was it like wasting?
So the question is, what happens to the frozen sperm or the frozen oocytes, the frozen eggs or frozen embryos, right, that couples have? What do we do with those? So essentially, I keep them frozen in cryo tanks that are filled with liquid nitrogen that we are constantly replenishing and replacing as it evaporates for really as long as a couple or a patient will want. The sperm, the oocytes, the embryos belong to the husband or the wife or the both as a couple, and it's really up to them to decide what they want me to do with them. So I have frozen gametes, frozen eggs really just for the past year or two, but frozen sperm that have been there for years and years, frozen embryos that probably date back already going back about 15 plus years, and they just sit there. And then what the question is, once couples decide that they're done with fertility, right, with their fertility endeavor, then what can they tell me to do with them? So I counsel couples that they have really three options. One option is to discard the sperm or the eggs or the embryos. One option is to donate to research, and you know, we have research studies that are ongoing that I can always use sperm, eggs, and embryos to use for that kind of research. And the other possibility is donation, right? A person can donate her oocytes, release them for donation. A couple can release its embryos for donation to another couple that has, let's say, both a sperm problem and an egg problem and is looking to adopt a child as an alternative, can be offered embryo donation so that they can actually adopt an embryo, essentially. And that's really the third possibility, is to donate them. Another possibility, which some post-skim ask me to do or ask the couples to talk to me about, is kind of, especially with sperm, using the sperm for sort of a kind of fake insemination, meaning to not just completely throw out the sperm, but to actually do an intravaginal insemination at any point in the woman's cycle, just so that it's, you know, being placed where it's supposed to be and not outright discarded, even if the wish of the couple is to discard it.
I guess my question specifically was halachically.
I think there are different poskim. I think the best thing to do actually is to use it for research if you're not going to use them anymore. I don't think there's any halacha problem with that, if you can do that. But I think that if they were expressed in order to be able to have children, and you're not using it for that, or you use some of it and you didn't use all of it, then if they want to destroy them, I think that you can destroy them.
Does that make it actually like asar? Like, because if you're saying that they're being removed to have children, but then they weren't, does it retroactively make?
I don't think so. Okay. If that. Okay, we take one more question, and then we're going to miss the chuppah if we don't. Just one more question there, but I'm sorry. Just decide.
Okay, thank you to the organizers and speakers for a very, very interesting talk. My question is to Dr. Levine. I was wondering if you could address the use of ovarian preservation for those young women for whom the treatment of their cancers does not allow time for harvesting the oocytes.
Yeah, so that technique is certainly feasible from a medical point of view, and the question was, can we actually preserve ovaries or ovarian tissue? And yes, you can do that. So the ability to freeze eggs really begins at the time of puberty, when a now young woman's body becomes sensitive to hormonal gonadotropins, to hormones that we use to help develop eggs and mature eggs that we can then retrieve and freeze. But if a prepubertal girl is going through some sort of, let's say, cancer treatment, which might be toxic to her ovaries. So there are different techniques that you can do to try to preserve her future fertility. One potential technique, if a person is having, let's say, radiation therapy, that's going to be kind of, the ovaries will be in the field of radiation, you can actually do surgery on the girl before the radiation treatment to try to move the ovaries outside of the field of radiation and suture them to the pelvic wall. So you can do that kind of technique. If that's not possible, or if you're giving chemotherapy, which you think will be damaging to the ovaries, you can actually do surgery to remove strips of cortical tissue from the ovaries, which is where the eggs are, and you can actually freeze those pieces of cortical tissue. And or you can even potentially take out the ovaries altogether and freeze the ovaries and hold on to them. And then later on, at some point in the future, you can actually transplant that ovarian tissue. You can either do a transplant in the same place where the ovaries are supposed to be to try to help that girl, now woman, become pregnant on her own, or you can actually do a heterotopic transplant, which means you can actually place the ovarian tissue in another spot, such as in the woman's forearm, where she won't be able to conceive on her own, but if you give her injectable hormones to develop some of those eggs, you can actually put a needle into her forearm and remove the eggs and use them to help with the pregnancy. So yes, those techniques can be done.
There are two babies in Israel, because this is still pretty experimental. There are two babies in Israel that have been born by the procedure that Dr. Levine just mentioned. Okay, thank you very much.